Chapter 30. There are not many places that I find it more agreeable to revisit when I am in an idle mood than some places to which I have never been. For my acquaintance with those spots is of such long standing, and has ripened into an intimacy of so affectionate a nature, that I take a particular interest in assuring myself that they are unchanged. I never was in Robinson Crusoe's island, yet I frequently return there. The colony he established on it soon faded away, and it is uninhabited by any descendants of the grave and courteous Spaniards, or of Will Atkins and the other mutineers, and has relapsed into its original condition. Not a twig of its wicker houses remains, its goats have long run wild again, its screaming parrots would darken the sun with a cloud of many flaming colors, if a gun were fired there, no faces ever reflected in the waters of the little creek which Friday swam across when pursued by his two brother cannibals with sharpened stomachs. After comparing notes with other travelers who have similarly revisited the island and conscientiously inspected it, I have satisfied myself that it contains no vestige of Mr. Atkins' domesticity or theology, though his track on the memorable evening of his landing, to set his captain ashore, when he was decoyed about and round about until it was dark, and his boat was stove, and his strength and spirits failed him, is yet plainly to be traced. So is the hilltop on which Robinson was struck dumb with joy, when the reinstated captain pointed to the ship, riding within half a mile of the shore, that was to bear him away, in the 29th year of his seclusion in that lonely place. So is the sandy beach on which the memorable footstep was impressed, and where the savages hauled up their canoes, when they came ashore for those dreadful public dinners, which led to a dancing worse than speech-making. So is the cave, where the flaring eyes of the old goat made such a goblin appearance in the dark. So is the site of the hut, where Robinson lived with the dog, and the parrot and the cat, and where he endured those first agonies of solitude, which strange to say never involved any ghostly fancies, a circumstance so very remarkable, that perhaps he left out something in writing his record. Round hundreds of such objects, hidden in the dense tropical foliage, the tropical sea breaks evermore, and over them the tropical sky, saving in the short rainy season, shines bright and cloudless. Neither was I ever belated among wolves, on the borders of France and Spain, nor did I ever, when night was closing in and the ground was covered with snow, draw up my little company among some felled trees which served as a breastwork, and there fire a train of gunpowder so dexterously that suddenly we had 30 or 40 blazing wolves illuminating the darkness around us. Nevertheless, I occasionally go back to that dismal region and perform the feat again, when indeed to smell the singeing, and the frying of the wolves afire, and to see them setting one another alight as they rush and tumble, and to behold them rolling in the snow vainly attempting to put themselves out, and to hear their howlings taken up by all the echoes as well as by all the unseen wolves within the woods, makes me tremble. I was never in the robber's cave, where Gil Blas lived, but I often go back there, and find the trapdoor just as heavy to raise as it used to be, while that wicked old disabled black lies everlastingly cursing in bed. I was never in Don Quixote's study, where he read his books of chivalry until he rose and hacked at imaginary giants, and then refreshed himself with great draughts of water, yet you couldn't move a book in it without my knowledge, or with my consent. I was never, thank heaven, in company with the little old woman who hobbled out of the chest, and told the merchant Abuda, to go in search of the talisman of Ormonds, yet I make it my business, to know that she is well preserved, and as intolerable as ever. I was never at the school, where the boy Horatio Nelson got out of bed to steal the pears. Not because he wanted any, but because every other boy was afraid. Yet I have several times been back to this academy, to see him let down out of window with a sheet. So with Damascus, and Baghdad, and Brobdingnag, which has the curious fate of being usually misspelt when written, and Lilliput, and Laputa, and the Nile, and Abyssinia, and the Ganges, and the North Pole, and many hundreds of places I was never at them, yet it is an affair of my life to keep them intact, and I am always going back to them. But, when I was in Dullborough one day, revisiting the associations of my childhood as recorded in previous pages of these notes, my experience in this wise was made quite inconsiderable, and of no account, by the quantity of places and people, utterly impossible places and people, but nonetheless alarmingly real, that I found I had been introduced to by my nurse, before I was 6 years old, and used to be forced to go back to at night without at all wanting to go. If we all knew our own minds in a more enlarged sense than the popular acceptation of that phrase, I suspect we should find our nurses responsible for most of the dark corners we are forced to go back to, against our wills. The first diabolical character who intruded himself on my peaceful youth, as I called to mind that day at Dullborough, was a certain Captain Murderer. This wretch must have been an offshoot of the Bluebeard family, but I had no suspicion of the consanguinity in those times. His warning name would seem to have awakened no general prejudice against him, for he was admitted into the best society and possessed immense wealth. Captain Murderer's mission was matrimony, and the gratification of a cannibal appetite with tender brides. On his marriage morning, he always caused both sides of the way to church to be planted with curious flowers, and when his bride said, "Dear Captain Murderer, I ever saw flowers like these before. What are they called?" ... he answered, "They are called garnish for house lamb," ... and laughed at his ferocious practical joke in a horrid manner, disquieting the minds of the noble bridal company, with a very sharp show of teeth, then displayed for the first time. He made love in a coach and six, and married in a coach and 12, and all his horses were milk-white horses with one red spot on the back which he caused to be hidden by the harness. For, the spot would come there, though every horse was milk-white, when Captain Murderer bought him. And the spot was young bride's blood. To this terrific point I am indebted for my first personal experience of a shudder and cold beads on the forehead. When Captain Murderer had made an end of feasting and revelry, and had dismissed the noble guests, and was alone with his wife on the day month after their marriage, it was his whimsical custom to produce a golden rolling pin and a silver pie board. Now, there was this special feature in the captain's courtships, that he always asked if the young lady could make pie crust, and if she couldn't by nature or education, she was taught. Well, when the bride saw Captain Murderer produce the golden rolling pin and silver pie board, she remembered this, and turned up her laced silk sleeves to make a pie. The captain brought out a silver pie dish of immense capacity, and the captain brought out flour, and butter and eggs and all things needful, except the inside of the pie. Of materials for the staple of the pie itself, the captain brought out none. Then said the lovely bride, "Dear Captain Murderer, what pie is this to be?" ... he replied, "A meat pie." ... then said the lovely bride, "Dear Captain Murderer, I see no meat." ... the captain humorously retorted, "Look in the glass." ... she looked in the glass, but still she saw no meat, and then the captain roared with laughter, and suddenly frowning and drawing his sword, bade her roll out the crust. So she rolled out the crust, dropping large tears upon it all the time, because he was so cross, and when she had lined the dish with crust, and had cut the crust all ready to fit the top, the captain called out, "I see the meat in the glass." ... and the bride looked up at the glass, just in time to see the captain cutting her head off. And he chopped her in pieces, and peppered her, and salted her, and put her in the pie, and sent it to the baker's, and ate it all, and picked the bones. Captain Murderer went on in this way, prospering exceedingly, until he came to choose a bride from two twin sisters, and at first, didn't know which to choose. For, though one was fair, and the other dark, They were both equally beautiful. But the fair twin loved him, and the dark twin hated him, so he chose the fair one. The dark twin would have prevented the marriage if she could, but she couldn't. However, on the night before it, much suspecting Captain Murderer, she stole out, and climbed his garden wall, and looked in at his window through a chink in the shutter, and saw him having his teeth filed sharp. Next day she listened all day, and heard him make his joke about the house lamb. And that day month, he had the paste rolled out, and cut the fair twin's head off, and chopped her in pieces, and peppered her, and salted her, and put her in the pie, and sent it to the baker's, and ate it all, and picked the bones. Now, the dark twin had had her suspicions much increased by the filing of the captain's teeth, and again by the house lamb joke. Putting all things together when he gave out that her sister was dead, she divined the truth, and determined to be revenged. So, she went up to Captain Murderer's house, and knocked at the knocker and pulled at the bell, and when the captain came to the door, said, "Dear Captain Murderer, marry me next, for I always loved you, and was jealous of my sister." Apostrophe The captain took it as a compliment, and made a polite answer, and the marriage was quickly arranged. On the night before it, the bride again climbed to his window, and again saw him having his teeth filed sharp. At this sight she laughed such a terrible laugh at the chink in the shutter, that the captain's blood curdled, and he said, "I hope nothing has disagreed with me." At that, she laughed again, a still more terrible laugh, and the shutter was opened and search made, but she was nimbly gone, and there was no one. Next day they went to church in a coach and 12, and were married. And that day month, she rolled the pie crust out, and Captain Murderer cut her head off, and chopped her in pieces, and peppered her, and salted her, and put her in the pie, and sent it to the baker's, and ate it all, and picked the bones. But before she began to roll out the paste she had taken a deadly poison of a most awful character, distilled from toad's eyes and spider's knees. And Captain Murderer had hardly picked her last bone, when he began to swell, and to turn blue, and to be all over spots, and to scream. And he went on swelling and turning bluer, and being more all over spots and screaming, until he reached from floor to ceiling, and from wall to wall. And then, at 1 o'clock in the morning, he blew up with a loud explosion. At the sound of it, all the milk-white horses in the stables broke their halters and went mad, and then they galloped over everybody in Captain Murderer's house, beginning with the family blacksmith who had filed his teeth, until the whole were dead, and then they galloped away. Hundreds of times did I hear this legend of Captain Murderer, in my early youth. And added hundreds of times was there a mental compulsion upon me in bed, to peep in at his window as the dark twin peeped, and to revisit his horrible house, and look at him in his blue and spotty and screaming stage, as he reached from floor to ceiling, and from wall to wall. The young woman who brought me acquainted with Captain Murderer, had a fiendish enjoyment of my terrors, and used to begin, I remember as a sort of introductory overture, by clawing the air with both hands, and uttering a long low hollow groan. So acutely did I suffer from this ceremony in combination with this infernal captain, that I sometimes used to plead I thought I was hardly strong enough, and old enough to hear the story again just yet. But, she never spared me one word of it, and indeed commanded the awful chalice to my lips as the only preservative known to science against the black cat, a weird and glaring-eyed supernatural Tom, who was reputed to prowl about the world by night, sucking the breath of infancy, and who was endowed with a special thirst, as I was given to understand, for mine. This female bard, may she have been repaid my debt of obligation to her in the matter of nightmares and perspirations, reappears in my memory as the daughter of a shipwright. Her name was Mercy, though she had none on me. There was something of a shipbuilding flavor in the following story, as it always recurs to me in a vague association with calomel pills. I believe it to have been reserved for dull nights, when I was low with medicine. There was once a shipwright, and he wrought in a government yard, and his name was Chips. And his father's name before him was Chips. And his father's name before him was Chips. And they were all Chipses. And Chips the father had sold himself to the devil for an iron pot, and a bushel of tenpenny nails and half a ton of copper, and a rat that could speak. And Chips the grandfather had sold himself to the devil for an iron pot, and a bushel of tenpenny nails and half a ton of copper, and a rat that could speak. And Chips the great-grandfather had disposed of himself in the same direction on the same terms, and the bargain had run in the family for a long, long time. So, one day, when young Chips was at work in the dock slip all alone, down in the dark hold of an old 74 that was hailed up for repairs, the devil presented himself, and remarked, "A lemon has pips, and a yard has ships, and I'll have chips." I don't know why, but this fact of the devil's expressing himself in rhyme was peculiarly trying to me. Chips looked up when he heard the words, and there he saw the devil with saucer eyes that squinted on a terrible great scale, and that struck out sparks of blue fire continually. And whenever he winked his eyes, showers of blue sparks came out, and his eyelashes made a clattering like flints and steel striking lights. And hanging over one of his arms by the handle was an iron pot, and under that arm was a bushel of tenpenny nails, and under his other arm was half a ton of copper, and sitting on one of his shoulders was a rat that could speak. So, the devil said again, "A lemon has pips, and a yard has ships, and I'll have chips." The invariable effect of this alarming tautology on the part of the evil spirit was to deprive me of my senses for some moments. So, Chips answered never a word, but went on with his work. "What are you doing, Chips?" Said the rat that could speak. "I am putting in new planks, where you and your gang have eaten old away," said Chips. "But we'll eat them too," said the rat that could speak. "And we'll let in the water and drown the crew, and we'll eat them too." Chips, being only a shipwright, and not a man of war's man, said, "You are welcome to it." But he couldn't keep his eyes off the half a ton of copper, or the bushel of tenpenny nails. For nails and copper are a shipwright's sweethearts, and shipwrights will run away with them whenever they can. So, the devil said, "I see what you are looking at, Chips. You had better strike the bargain. You know the terms. Your father before you was well acquainted with them, and so were your grandfather and great-grandfather before him." Says Chips, "I like the copper, and I like the nails, and I don't mind the pot, but I don't like the rat." Says the devil, fiercely, "You can't have the metal without him, and he's a curiosity. I'm going." Chips, afraid of losing the half a ton of copper and the bushel of nails, then said, "Give us hold." So, he got the copper and the nails, and the pot and the rat that could speak, and the devil vanished. Chips sold the copper, and he sold the nails, and he would have sold the pot. But whenever he offered it for sale, the rat was in it, and the dealers dropped it, and would have nothing to say to the bargain. So, Chips resolved to kill the rat, and, being at work in the yard one day with a great kettle of hot pitch on one side of him, and the iron pot with the rat in it on the other, he turned the scalding pitch into the pot, and filled it full. Then, he kept his eye upon it till it cooled and hardened, and then he let it stand for 20 days, and then he heated the pitch again, and turned it back into the kettle, and then he sank the pot in water for 20 days more, and then he got the smelters to put it in the furnace for 20 days more, and then they gave it him out, red hot, and looking like red hot glass instead of iron, yet there was the rat in it, just the same as ever. And the moment it caught his eye, it said with a jeer, "A lemon has pips, and a yard has ships, and I'll have chips." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.